your role in green remediation, implementation and case studies in green remediation, this year's models and tools. This is the second session of a three-part series. The first one was held in December, and the last one will be held on Thursday, February 10th, next month, and it will start at 1 o'clock Eastern Time. We'll get started in a few moments, but while we're waiting for others to log on, just like to go over a few housekeeping items. When you registered, you should have been directed to this seminar's specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. If you have not checked for today's seminar, please just take a minute to do so. If you have any questions for any of today's presenters that are not answered during today's webinar, you can always send them to the presenters directly or send them to me, which is sperry.clint@epa.gov. For those of you joining us via the phone lines, we request that you put your phone lines on mute during the seminar. We will have a question and answer session near the end of each hour, at which point you're welcome to take your phone off mute and ask your question. If you do not have a mute button on your phone, we ask that you take a moment right now to hit *6, which will mute your line. When we get to the question and answer period, you can hit #6 to unmute your phone. This will hopefully reduce the background noises that can disrupt the quality of the audio transmission. Also, please do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music or advertisements that can be very disruptive to the call. So again, please keep us on mute and please do not put us on hold. For those of you online, you should have clicked on the agenda for today's Go To session icon, which should be on slide #1 of the presentation. The main page contains the slides, above which you'll find navigation icons. You may also submit questions by using the question mark icon, which you should see above the slide. You do not need to wait if you have until the question and answer period to submit your questions. So, in fact, we actually encourage you to submit them as you have them in your minds, to go ahead and submit your questions in advance of the question and answer session. Also, if you have any experience in experienced technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the question mark icon to alert us to the technical difficulties you might be encountering. Please also include a telephone number where you can be reached, and we'll try to help you troubleshoot your problem. The presenter will be announcing the number of the slides which he or she is moving. You may also advance to the next slide using the single right arrow, which is located above the slide, or clicking on the appropriate slide number in the left-hand frame. As stated earlier, we'll have a question and answer session after each half of the webinar. If you would like to bring your attention to the additional resources link at the bottom of the front page, where we have assembled a series of documents and websites directly applicable to today's topic. This will help stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given to today. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We would ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. And we do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and the delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation on today's event. Lastly, this event will be recorded and archived on the CLUIN website. Within 1 to 2 weeks, you will be able to download it in several formats or replay it online. You will need to subscribe to our CLUIN podcast to receive new archived seminars as they become available at the www.cluin.org/live website. And now that the housekeeping portion is complete, let's kick off the session. In May 2010, EPA held its annual National Association of Remedial Project Managers in Arlington, Virginia. One of the most well-attended sessions was the Green Remediation. Because of its success, members of the EPA's Technical Support Project Engineering Forum, in particular the Green Remediation Subcommittee, have brought back many of the same talks and divided them into 3 2-hour webinars. EPA uses the definition, a definition of green remediation, which includes the practice of considering the environmental effects of a remediation strategy early in the process and incorporating options to maximize the net environmental benefit of the cleanup actions. Others are still emerging, including the use of renewable energy sources such as wind, solar, and solar to power remedial systems. Over the three sessions, the online training introduces you to the key technical policy and application aspects of green remediation. Before I turn it over to our first today's seven speakers, I remind phone participants to please put your phones on mute, and if you don't have a mute button on your phone, hit star six now, and again, please do not put us on hold. Today's first speaker is Hillary Thornton, who is an RPM out of EPA's Region 3 office. He will be talking about green remediation fact sheets. Welcome, Hillary.
Thank you, Clint. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine, thanks.
Great. With that, this is green remediation. The adolescent is maturing. Starts with slide 6 in your assembled slides. And I'm going to talk today some about the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Enforcement series of green remediation best management practices fact sheets. So if you advance to the next slide on using the fact sheets as tools, we want to remember that these tools, these fact sheets, are developed to document best management practices for reducing the environmental footprint of remedies commonly used at Superfund sites and the activities that are common to all sorts of cleanups. So although these are prepared for the Superfund program, they do have applicability beyond Superfund, where other cases where similar sorts of cleanups are applied. They're done and can be used to facilitate brainstorming during cleanup planning or remedy implementation and optimization. They provide common ground for many organizations that are working to make cleanups greener. They describe methods complementing federal and state goals concerning climate change. As we hear about climate change, these greener cleanups activities fit right into supporting those goals as well. There are tools on slide 8 to identify quantifiable measures for energy efficiency, use of renewable energy, use of materials and services manufactured or provided through sustainable practices and with a small footprint. Measures for water conservation and beneficial reuse of water. Remediation and redevelopment of contaminated property and preservation of currently undisturbed property. Preservation of existing ecosystems and recycled materials reuse. And as noted at the bottom of the slide, watch for a 2011 release of a methodology for assessing the environmental footprint of a cleanup. On slide 9, there are a number of topics listed there on which we've recently released one of these BMP fact sheets. Bioremediation, soil vapor extraction and air sparging, clean fuel and emission technologies for site cleanup, and a number of earlier releases, such as incorporating sustainable practices into site remediation, excavation and surface restoration, site investigation, and pump and treat technology. So you can see we've had quite a few of these, and we've got more coming along in the pipeline. But before we get to the ones that are coming up in the future, let's look in detail at a couple of these to give you a little more feel for what they're like. Some sample BMP on site investigation on slide 10. If you are doing site investigation, you might want to consider integrating site characterization with your remedial plans and site reuse. Minimize field mobilization and in-person meetings. I think we all understand that sometimes there is benefit to an in-person meeting, but a lot of times we hop in the car or hop on a plane and fly out or drive out to a site, spend a couple days traveling, and we're only there for a few hours. Interact briefly with people, really don't convey any information that couldn't have been passed over the telephone. Try to avoid those. Cut that sort of meeting out of your travel schedule, and that will save a lot of carbon emissions and reduce your footprint of your cleanup. use remote direct sensing tools, real-time data collection methods. Tremendous value there in collecting data quickly. And if you can do it using remote sensing or direct sensing, then the footprint involved in collecting that data can be significantly reduced. Deploy direct push technology in place of conventional well drilling when possible. On page 11, use low-flow sampling devices and test kits. Some of these things are things that you may have been doing for years. Low-flow sampling and test kits are not new technologies. They're not something that's inherently a greener technology, but the use of them as part of an overall greener cleanup approach is very appropriate. We need to remember that remediation of a site is inherently, in and of itself, a green thing to do. Leaving the site dirty is not green. Cleaning up is green, and we're trying to be greener as we clean up. So let's institute environmentally friendly and local purchasing strategies for products and services and establish paperless data sharing. Looking on slide 12, an example of BMPs from Pump and Treat Technologies from that BMP fact sheet. Optimize. And optimize your pump and treat system so that you are using the appropriately sized equipment. You're cleaning up water that actually is contaminated and needs to be cleaned up. You want to find opportunities to use renewable energy where you can. Use closed loop systems and reuse the treated water. Consider modular designs for extraction systems, so that if one portion of your system needs to be changed out with the modular nature, you won't have to throw the whole thing away and start fresh. You can just change out that particular module. On page 13, pump in a pulse mode and use electricity or utilities at off-peak times where you can. Use other technologies in the source and in fringe areas. You don't have to use the same technology all the way across your site, the most central area of your plume and the most distant fringes. You can use a blend of technologies that optimizes your energy usage. Plan options for switching or augmenting with policing technologies at defined thresholds. Likewise, to not having to use the same technology throughout the aerial extent of a contamination plume. You don't have to use the same technology over the entire time that your remediation is occurring. You can switch to a technology that might be more energy efficient at a later stage. Maybe it makes sense to put a lot of energy into the first 6 months or first year of treatment, knock the levels down a great deal, but then when you've got most of the contamination addressed and you only have that residual fraction, switch technologies to something low energy and go the rest of the way with that. That would be a greener remediation approach, consideration of that. Eliminate treatment train components that are becoming marginally effective as conditions change. On page 14, apply remediation. Thoroughly characterize your subsurface conditions and use good models. The better you understand what's going on in the subsurface, the more you can precisely target your approach and deliver your remediation, spend your energy budget wisely. Field test the delivery method to ensure proper dispersion and consider using gravity feed where that's appropriate. Sometimes you can use industrial or agricultural waste products as microbial stimulation agents, and that sort of reuse is a greener approach. On slide 15, employ groundwater recirculation processes. Where you can, deliver any high-volume products by rail. You probably hear the rail industry's ads about how they can move a ton of freight 440 miles with a gallon of diesel fuel. There's certainly something to be said for bringing in and taking out high-volume products by rail. If you have hundreds of thousands of yards of soil to move, or if you have large volumes of reagents to move, consider rail, especially if it's a former industrial site that's already served by a rail spur. reclaim reject water from on-site activities for uses in injection slurries or as chase water. On page 16, we can look at some BMPs from SVE and air sparging. Use vacuum pumps and blowers, including multiple low-flow blowers that can accommodate changes. You can shut one or two of the pumps off sometime when that's appropriate and not just expend energy running them. If you have a single pump, if you are able to select equipment motor with variable frequency drive, you could downrate that pump or motor automatically and optimize your energy usage. Determine airflow rates that can meet objectives while minimizing energy consumption. On slide 17, regenerate adsorptive media such as GAC filters. If you're using granular activated carbon, look at the regeneration of that. Minimize noise by using centrifugal blowers, exhaust mufflers, and soundproofing material. Automate systems with equipment such as electronic pressure transducers and data loggers. I know a couple of my sites, we use data loggers and electronic pressure transducers, and they're telling us a tremendous amount of information about our groundwater flow characteristics. And in addition to getting a better understanding of the site and the site conditions, we're able to apply that better understanding to optimize the flow of our systems and cut waste out. And the waste you eliminate is greening your cleanup. On page 18, I'll talk a little bit about the fact sheet development process. How do these BMP fact sheets that EPA headquarters in conjunction with others develops, how does that development process work? Well, first, a draft is circulated to OSWR and the other agency program offices in EPA headquarters. Then regional distribution occurs through the Superfund green remediation coordinators and work groups, such as some of the Superfund green remediation teams. There is distribution to external groups, such as FRTR, ITRC, and ASWAMO. There is technological input from the Engineering Forum Green Remediation Subcommittee. And as noted in the box at the bottom of the slide, we encourage you to get involved and add your own ideas. Let us know what topics we haven't covered yet that would be good to have a best management practice fact sheet about. To give you a real-world example of that, we held a meeting in October of this year at which we solicited new ideas, and it was put forward that it would be useful with all of the underground storage tank cleanup that's occurring, some of that being done with stimulus funding. It would be good to have a greener cleanup fact sheet, BMPs for UST cleanup. So that headquarters already has a draft out for review on that. Just a couple of months after the suggestion was made, we are taking action on that. So on slide 19, my last slide, I identify some upcoming topics and point you to a wonderful site to get other green remediation tools. The site is shown on the right-hand side of the slide. It's www.cluein.org/green remediation. That is your best single-stop page to find all sorts of information about greener cleanups, including all of these best management practices fact sheets that I've been promoting to you this morning or this afternoon, depending on your time zone. There is information on there with regional policies, national policies, best management fact sheets. There's information on contracting. There's a wealth of information there on cluein.org.
Going back to Lincoln Park, get shot at. What was that?
Really, sorry, there's some sound in the background there. Somebody needs to go on mute. Let me finish up here with the left-hand slide of slide 19. We have fact sheets coming up on integrating renewable energy into site cleanup, on underground storage tanks, as I mentioned, on landfill covers and containment technologies, in-situ thermal technologies, contracting mechanisms for site cleanup, and also, as I mentioned earlier, the environmental footprint analysis of site cleanup. And to suggest additional topics or tools, please contact Carlos Pachon at EPA headquarters, and his email is on the bottom of the slide there, pachon.carlos@epa.gov. With that, I'll turn it back over to Clint. Thank you very much for the opportunity to address the group, and I hope this has been helpful. If you have questions for me, I will stick around, and you can ask them during the Q&A period coming up.
Thanks, Hillary. Great discussion on fact sheets. As a reminder, please, phone participants, put your phones on mute, and also hold your questions, of course, till the end of the hour. At this point in time, we have a couple of questions, so make sure that go ahead and write your questions down at this time, and we'll answer them here at the end of this first session. Our next speaker is Patricia Overmeyer. She works out of our headquarters office, and we'll be discussing green remediation from the brownfields point of view. Welcome, Patricia.
Good afternoon. Thanks, everyone. Yes, I am Patricia Overmeyer. I'm EPA's Land Revitalization Coordinator, and I work in the Brownfields and Land Revitalization Office. So I work across both the land revitalization activities at the agency as well as in the Brownfields Program. In the Brownfields Program at the federal level, as well as the Land Revitalization Program, we are trying to promote greener cleanups and the reduction of our carbon footprints, as well as a reduction of our entire environmental footprint. So we're promoting the reduction of water use, the reduction of energy use, the increase in renewable energy use, and whatever aspects that we can use to make our cleanups greener. A lot of those things Hillary just went over in the fact sheets, and the fact sheets are very useful for helping users who are designing cleanups or working towards remedial activities to get information on how to do better, greener cleanups. Now, under a lot of EPA programs, the federal government can also impose greener cleanups either through our oversight of Superfund cleanups or through the permitting process under RCRA. However, on the federal level with the Brownfields program, we do not have federal brownfields cleanup standards. So although we can promote and encourage folks to do greener cleanups when they're cleaning up brownfields, we really need to work within our state programs, because we highly recommend and encourage all brownfields to be cleaned up under state response programs. So when cleaning up a brownfield, we point people towards their cleanup programs at the state level. So we are working with SWAMO and with our state partners to encourage them to incorporate greener cleanup principles into their state response programs. However, it doesn't. A lot of state programs, even if they don't have greener cleanup principles, would probably applaud users using greener cleanup principles or any of the aspects of greener cleanups that Hillary mentioned in his fact sheets. A lot of states would allow you to implement them within the course of their cleanup programs and their state voluntary cleanup programs, as long as you are also meeting the cleanup conditions and the remedy conditions that are imposed by the state for the particular property that you're cleaning up. So the takeaway really is that greener cleanups are important. They're important to the Brownfields program as much as they're important to the Superfund program, the RCRA program, the Federal Facilities program at EPA. We encourage it. We promote it. We ask you to look to the fact sheets, look to EPA's greener cleanup principles. But just remember, in the Brownfields program, you do need to look to your state cleanup programs for direction and oversight. So we will work with those programs to ask the states to incorporate all aspects of the principles for greener cleanups, and even prior to the states incorporating such aspects, I think that you'll find that they will be friendly and amicable toward folks who want to incorporate these kinds of principles in the cleanup. So you just need to work with your states. One other thing I just wanted to mention that will also assist, I think, brownfield property owners who are doing cleanups and help with and the encouragement of greener cleanup principles being adopted by states is the fact that EPA's working group has a working group that's working with ASTM International to develop a standard guide for implementing greener cleanups into all remedial and cleanup programs. So we're still in the early stages of that, but ASTM International has taken on the task of developing a standard, a business standard for how to implement greener cleanups within all aspects of remedial design and implementation. And we think that the standard guide that will be developed will be beneficial to all types of cleanups, including brownfield cleanups. And I think absent a federal program for brownfield cleanups, and until the states fully develop greener cleanup principles within their cleanup programs, the ASTM standard may be useful. So we're working with that standards development organization, ASTM International, to develop the standard to assist our stakeholders, brownfield stakeholders, as well as Superfund stakeholders and RCRA stakeholders in thinking through how to apply greener cleanup standards to individual cleanup programs. And that's all I have.
Thanks, Patricia. Thanks for giving us an update on the standard. That's something that's definitely going to be very important here coming up in the next, hopefully, short year or so. Our next speaker is Rusty Harris-Bishop. He is an RPM out of EPA's Region 9 office. He will give us a brief update on GR activities in Region 9. Welcome, Rusty.
Thanks, Clint. Just for everyone on the phone, Region 9 is the Pacific Southwest region of EPA. We encompass California, Arizona, Nevada, Hawaii, and the Pacific Islands. And our greener cleanups policy was signed in September of 2009, and it was signed by both our waste and Superfund division directors, and it incorporates all of our cleanup programs. So that's NPL sites, removals, underground storage tank program, RCRA corrective action sites, and brownfields. And so what we've tried to do is it's fairly explicit. We have the five areas that I think the national policy have also cover. But in addition, one of the things that we like to focus on is, if we want to go to the next slide, renewable energy, because we do have in the Pacific Southwest, we have a high potential for generating renewable energy. Just one thing about our region that's maybe different from other regions is our sites. We provide drinking water directly to people through our cleanup programs. I don't know if other regions do this, but we provide drinking water to about 500,000 households every day. So our remedies have to operate 24/7, 365 days a year with a good deal of accuracy and reliability, because that's part of our remedy and beneficial reuse of water, which we think is a more, green and sustainable use of water, since we are in a drought and drier climate. So for the status of our could you go back one? We're on page 23, yeah. Our RPMs, I think we have a high awareness of the regional policy, and we have a lot of RPMs who would like to be able to do greener things on their sites, but I think that then becomes their awareness varies about what can be accomplished. Since we do have a large focus on renewable energy, we look at open space, proximity to transmission lines. what are the needs on the site versus what could we be transmitting off-site. I think we're a little less successful in terms of implementing other greener elements of the program, like incorporating recycled materials into our construction. But I think water conservation is something where we have done a pretty good job. We have a couple of sites that I just wanted to mention where we've had some success. The Aerojet site in Rancho Cordova, California, has a 6-megawatt solar facility that provides about 30% of all of its power needed for their groundwater treatment system. I think it's the largest solar plant on an NPL site at this point. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong. And then we also have in Davis, California, the Frontier Fertilizer site, which at this point for their groundwater treatment system is 100% solar powered. They did a lot of work to optimize the pumps and install variable frequency pumps so that they could use solar power. They are going to implement a thermal remedy for the soil cleanup that is not going to be solar powered, but they did a lot of work to try and site a solar farm to provide that power, and it just didn't come out. We didn't prevail on that. But that's one thing to keep in mind, is that if you want to start looking at renewable energy for a remedy, you have to start really early. It takes a lot of people input to implement renewable energy at a site. We've also got an OSC that's looking to do one of the greenest removals in the country. It's a residential lead removal, so we're looking at trying to do in-situ fixation of the lead using a recycled or a waste product from fish processing to help fix the lead in soil, using electric vehicles on site, employing local labor through the Brownfields job training program and the Superfund job training initiative. And then we have some pilots where we're looking at solar power at the Stringfellow landfill and wind power at the Leviathan mine. So we have a lot of things underway, and hopefully we'll have more success stories in the next year. We also have a Brownfields program sustainability pilot or contact here, so she's always looking for ways to get that information out to our Brownfields grantees on how they can improve their programs. And in the region, we have the, in our RECRA program, the piloting the footprint analysis protocol that was mentioned previously by Hillary. That was started in Region 9 to develop it for one site, and now we're piloting that protocol on a couple sites around the country just to see how it, how we can standardize it. Next slide. For 2011, we have a couple of goals. We'd like to see if we can put renewable energy on all of our fund lead sites, fund lead and special account operated sites that are in long-term O&M. And we'd also like to see if we can generate renewable energy as part of site reuse, if that's a possibility. And we've had in place for a couple years the contract language to use clean diesel technology at all of our sites, but it's been a little bit more challenging to get that implemented, and so we're looking at how we can revise our language so that we can have that implemented and documented if it's not available, so that we can learn from that and get more biodiesel and cleaner trucks on the road at our sites so that we're reducing the air impacts from our construction. And then we're going to need to continue to educate our staff and our contractors on the policy, these elements, the fact sheets, and the other opportunities that we have for doing greener cleanups. And ultimately, I'd like to have every one of our projects evaluated for some sort of green element and have that to be like a checkoff box that you've looked at all of these different areas and nothing's available. So we'll see how that goes. That's probably a down-the-road two-year goal. And then lastly, I just want to talk about some of the challenges that I brought up before in other forums, and just to keep it in mind is, you know, we have a great policy, but how do we implement it? How do we document the benefits? And then how, you know, in what phases of the project are we implementing it? If we select a biological treatment technology because we think it's going to work the best and be the most effective, and it also happens to save the most energy, how do we go about documenting what we're saving? It's hard to quantify that negative, but we probably need to have some guidance on how we're how to document what we're doing and what we're saving. And to continue to let our project managers and contractors know what the technical resources that are out there, to help them in assessing green options, and then how do we pay for these greener options that may cost more up front, like renewable energy to power cleanup, but if we've got a pump and treat system that's planned to run for 30 years, why are we evaluating it against a 3-year payback period? I think we need some guidance on how to do these things that are maybe broader term, longer vision options. And then also, how do we figure where climate change fits into the 9 criteria, since states are implementing climate change programs. California has a law on the books now addressing climate change, and so when do we start making those ARARS determinations and how it impacts our cleanups? So with that, I'll turn it over back to Clint, and I'll be here for questions at the end.
Thanks, Rusty. Region 9, California always seems to be leading the way with some of these type of things, so I appreciate it. Our next speaker is Beth Sheldrake. She works in EPA's Region 10 office, and she will be giving us an update on green remediation in that region. And just to let everyone know, we should be on slide 26. Welcome, Beth.
Thank you, Clint. Yeah, my name is Beth Sheldrake, and I'm a manager here in our Superfund program. Moving to slide 27, just a bit about our region. You know, we're a pretty small region as far as staff and industrial base, but we have a very large land mass, which means a lot of remote sites in Alaska and Idaho in particular. The Superfund program, you know, relatively small, about 35 active sites. Our RIPRA program is delegated to our states in 3 of our 4 states, so that presents some challenges. And just, I won't go into the details of the brownfields and underground storage tank program, but just want to give you a little perspective on our region. So we've been working over the last couple of years, I'm on slide 28, to raise the awareness of green remediation in Region 10. In 2009, we signed what we call our Clean and Green Policy, and similar to Region 9, it does cover all of our cleanup programs, which are actually located in 3 different offices in Region 10, but it covers Superfund, Brownfields, RCRA, and our underground storage tank cleanup programs. We've also been facilitating contractor presentations, webinars such as this, and doing outreach, just trying to, again, raise the awareness of what it really means when we talk about green remediation. Our Brownfields program, as Patricia was talking about, a lot of focus goes to raising the awareness at the state level and working with our grantees and state partners in building their programs. And then one thing we've kind of piloted in our Superfund program is a concept of a green team, where as sites are moving through the process and as they're getting towards design and implementation, we have one-on-one consultation with project managers to guide them through the process. We've found that a lot of our project managers tend to get overwhelmed by the amount of information available, so when we work one-on-one, we have a little more success. On slide 29, our clean and green policy, similar to, I think, most regions now have a clean and green policy. Ours was modeled very heavily off of Region 2's policy, who I think was the first to put one out there. But the goal is to enhance the environmental benefits of our cleanups by promoting practices and technologies that are sustainable. The concept we used in our policy was to establish some points of departure where all sites must at least explore implementing these elements, and I'll go into those on the next slide, or provide a site-specific reason why they can't implement these practices. But again, you know, our policy doesn't change, you know, how or why we make a cleanup decision, but we're focusing on the implementation of those cleanup decisions. On slide 30 are the what we call our points of departure in our policy, which are, again, the elements that every site needs to look at. 100% use of renewable energy, use of clean fuels and technologies, water conservation, recycling, both of the, you know, the former industrial materials at the site, but also things that are used on the site, and environmentally preferable purchasing, use of green concrete, and methane capture. The next slide, slide 31, some of the challenges. As I mentioned, we've struggled a bit with project managers feeling like this is just one more thing for them to think about when they're being pulled in a lot of different directions by stakeholders and PRPs and trying to put a real face on what we mean by green remediation has been a challenge. You know, educating folks on how we can identify opportunities within the cleanup process. Our underground storage tank program has struggled a bit because they lack direct control over their cleanups, except for those on tribal lands, so we're making some headway there. We're also lagging a bit behind some of the other regions in developing a systematic way to collect and track the data showing the environmental benefits. As Rusty mentioned, you know, we need to be able to show how, especially if we're implementing more costly remedies, what the environmental benefits are. Also, we've had some struggles with our Office of Regional Council and PRPs in particular not willingly volunteering to do some of these things. So we'd like to see some standard language in model AOCs and consent decrees so we're not negotiating these each time. And then we have one site in particular, the Lower Duwamish Waterway site, a large waterway in the Seattle area, where the PRPs actually made an overt attempt to use remediation to justify basically very little cleanup. So we've had to kind of re-educate them as far as what the purpose of our green remediation policy is. Slide 32, we have had some successes, however. Like many regions, most of our remediation contracts do have some language dealing with green remediation, as well as our interagency agreements, and it varies depending on what type of contract we're talking about. Our RCRA program for all remedial alternatives that they evaluate on their corrective action sites, they need to report the measures taken to reduce the impacts of the cleanup. Our Brownfields program did a evaluation of solar power at a former gas station, and those results are still pending. Back in the Superfund program, we provide each of our states some capacity building grant money called our CORE grant. And over the last year, we've worked with our state partners to implement green remediation in each of those CORE grants so that they can begin to better integrate green remediation into their own cleanup programs. And then getting, again, back to the site-specific level where we feel like we get the most success when we start talking to actual project managers that are at the stage in their project where they're starting to procure construction services. We develop procurement strategies to implement our greener practices. Like most regions, we've been trying to the maximum extent practicable to use clean fuel technologies and clean fuels at all of our sites for the last number of years, as well as encouraging engine retrofits. We invested some fairly significant regional dollars to upgrade all of our regional vehicles and our vessels, our boats, both with engine filters and use of clean fuels. I'm on slide 33 now. One site I wanted to highlight in particular, it's called the Well 12A Superfund site. It's in the city of Tacoma. And it's a former industrial facility with soil and groundwater contamination. And we just issued a ROD amendment last year and are moving into the procurement stage of for the construction services. It's kind of a phased cleanup with some excavation, some in situ thermal, some enhanced bio, and then gas extraction and treatment if necessary. So for this project, slide 34, we went through an analysis with the help of folks in headquarters, Carlos Pachon's group, to do a carbon footprint analysis of the various aspects of this cleanup. And so I know the chart is difficult to read, but basically it breaks down excavation, the excavation phase, in situ thermal, enhanced bio, and gas extraction and treatment, and looks at the various energy, water demands, CO2, NOx and SOx releases, particulate matter, and you can read down the chart there. And then basically we tried to identify where we might get the biggest bang for our buck in making modifications to as part of our procurement strategy. So what this analysis showed was that the excavation and off-site disposal portion of this remedy was the most energy intensive. In the Northwest, a lot of our energy is already pretty green, comes from hydroelectric power for the most part. So, you know, these kind of analyses differ very widely across the country, whereas probably in the Eastern Seaboard, you might see the thermal part of this remedy having the highest environmental footprint. But here in the West, where our energy is fairly green, as I said, the excavation was had the largest footprint or the largest impact. So we looked at specifically at that area of the cleanup. I'm on site 35 now, and wrote into the actual contract, the procurement plans, and into the contract documents some specific measures that we want the contractor to take to reduce the impact of this cleanup, such as using local borrow sources, recycling the concrete, pre-characterization of soil, looking at where the soil is going and the treatment that's required and how they're getting their energy. Transportation, as Hillary mentioned, has a large environmental footprint. You know, clean diesel technologies, idling programs for the excavation portion. The only other thing I'll mention that was a modification to the design is we looked at the volume of excavation versus how much thermal treatment, and again, because of the relatively lower environmental footprint of the thermal treatment, we actually reduced the excavation volume and increased the targeted areas for thermal treatment to kind of balance out the energy and carbon footprint demands of those two phases of the project. Now I'm on slide 36, and that's just the contact information for the various folks in Region 10 who work within the programs on green remediation. And with that, I will turn it back over to Clint.
Thanks, Beth. Sounds like Region 10 definitely has a lot of success stories and a good presentation on that last site. Our final speaker for this hour is Stephanie Vaughn. Stephanie is a RPM from EPA Region 2 office, and she will be discussing implementing regional GR policies. Again, she's our final speaker for this session, so if you've had any questions for the previous speakers, now is the time to go ahead and type them in. Thanks. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you, Clint. Good morning or good afternoon, everyone. Just to put things in perspective, Region 2 is in it covers New York, New Jersey, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. And today I'm going to be talking about kind of really the nuts and bolts of implementing a green remediation policy. We've heard two great presentations from Regions 9 and 10, and our policy really doesn't differ much from their policies, but I'm going to go into more detail on how we actually went about making it effective. So the Region 2 Clean and Green Policy was, I'm on slide 38 now. Our policy was signed on March 17, 2009. As Beth mentioned, it was indeed the first regional policy, and we updated it on March 11, 2010. The policy applies to all Superfund, RCRA, and brownfields work, and basically all cleanup programs within the region. and it applies to both fund and PRP lead sites. Key component of the policy is what we call touchstone practices, and those are listed on slide 39. Our current list of touchstone practices includes 100% use of 100% of electricity from renewable resources, and that can include the purchase of renewable energy credits to offset our electricity or non-renewable energy electricity usage at our sites. The second touchstone is the use of clean diesel fuels and technologies, which can include anything and everything from implementing an anti-idling program on a site to using cleaner fuels to retrofitting engines, methane capture at landfill sites, and finally materials reuse, reduction, or recycling. That covers the full gamut of materials. And a key thing to note is that the touchstone practices, much like in Region 10, they're required at all sites unless the site-specific evaluation demonstrates impracticability or favors an alternate green approach. I want to make clear that this list is not meant to be exclusive. These are kind of the minimum which we think should be evaluated at all sites. But there are many, many other techniques, strategies, ways of greening a cleanup. And we, of course, welcome as much innovation as people want to make. So now going on to slide 40, we signed this policy, and then a number of questions came up. We had some technical questions. How do we actually implement the policy, and can or should a practice be applied at my site? For example, is the use of cleaner fuels on non-dedicated trucks for a site, is that worthwhile? There are policy questions. How do we make our contractors and how do we make our PRPs, those are potentially responsible parties, follow the policy? And they question what impact will implementation of these policies have on our budget? And finally, how do we measure results? So those are the main questions we had. Going to slide 41, in order to help answer those questions, we formed a regional work group that consisted of 5 subcommittees covering kind of all aspects of the remedial process. And the important thing to note here is that the work group is comprised of individuals from almost every division to allow for cross-divisional knowledge exchange, which really is important. I work in the Superfund division. We don't use things like the diesel emissions quantifier ever, really. But we do have a group here in Region 2, a mobile source team that does that, works with that calculator all the time. And so we learned that pulling resources from within the region and from other places is really valuable and reduced the amount of the level of effort for those of us trying to implement the policy. Now I'll go through each of the work groups a bit. First, from a policy and legal standpoint, we are requiring incorporation of the policy. I wrote here on the slide green remediation language, but it's really the policy, into all of our new records of decisions and PRP orders or agreements. We are requesting that PRPs working under an existing order, an order that was signed prior to the policy, comply with the policy. In order to make that request, we developed a letter, which we asked all our project managers to send to their responsible parties. We also decided that the policy, the list of touchstones, is a living document, and that we would update the touchstone practices regularly. And I should note here that a key distinction that needs to be made is implementation versus remedy selection, and others have already touched on that, but our policy to this point has really focused on remedy implementation, ways to green, to implement a greener cleanup or a greener site investigation, rather than incorporating green remediation into the remedy selection process. So here's a couple of examples of the actual language we used. In our rods, we've added this paragraph. I'll read it. Consistent with EPA Region 2's clean and green policy, EPA will evaluate the use of sustainable technologies and practices with respect to the remedial alternatives selected for the site. So basically, we are saying that they must comply with the regional policy, and the regional policy itself explains what complying with the policy means. So we try to keep our ROD, our enforcement agreement, our contract language as simple as possible. So this particular language has been placed in all ROD signs since implementation of the policy, and I believe that number is 17. So similarly, here's the language we've been putting or in our enforcement agreements. We've been putting this language or something similar in the statement of work section, usually. Test to identify how the remedial design and the remedial action will be implemented using the principles in EPA Region 2's clean and green policy. So, again, this language or something similar has been placed in all enforcement agreements issued since implementation of the policy. And the key takeaway point here is that inclusion of this language has not held up the finalization of any enforcement agreement. We've not had a single PRP say, oh, we're not going to sign this order because of green remediation. So that's very positive. And in fact, the PRPs have been generally supportive. Moving on to slide 45, in order to implement the policy, it's also important to get it into our contracts. There is currently language in the terms and conditions section of our interagency agreements. Generally, those are with the Army Corps of Engineers. The language is binding on the Corps, not their contractor, so therefore it is up to the Corps to make sure that their contractor that they manage on EPA's behalf follows the policy. And they are then modifying their specifications that they issue to their contractors. And again, it's simple on our part. Language has also been placed in the statement of work section of all our remedial action contracts or RACs contracts. It's been placed in our site assessment contracts, and it's currently being finalized for our removal action and some other contracts. So now, both legally and contractually, the policy is a part of our way of doing business within the region moving forward. The next kind of question that we had in implementing the policy was how do you actually implement it. So for that, we focused on technical and outreach. And we took a two-prong approach. We created region-specific how-to guidelines for project managers. And these are really, when I say region-specific, they include information like, if you want to purchase renewable energy in New Jersey, contact these people. They explain the kind of nuts and bolts of what we're doing, how to do it, some basic science behind why we're doing it. And we already have those guidelines for clean diesel and renewable energy. We're also concurrently with that conducting regional training. And we've also created site assessment, RIFS and RDRA idea checklists. As I said, this policy is not exclusive. So there are many other things you can do to green your site. And these idea checklists are very similar to the BMP fact sheets that Hillary mentioned earlier. Moving on to slide 47. The next topic we needed to cover was metrics. How do we measure our results? So I'll quickly, there's a lot of information on these next few slides. I'm not going to read through it all, but you can look at it if you're interested. So the first touchstone was use of 100% renewable sources of energy on site. The data you need in order to measure that, in order to measure the environmental benefit of using the renewable sources of energy, is the kilowatt hours of electricity used and the zip code of the site. The reason you need the zip code of the site is something that Beth described in the previous presentation. Every utility receives a different mix of energy for their site. On the East Coast, generally, anywhere, at least in New Jersey, anywhere from 10 to 20% of the energy received from your regular utility is generated from renewable resources. So when you calculate the carbon dioxide offset by the purchase of renewable energy credits, the calculator subtracts out the amount of renewable energy that you're actually using at your site. So there is an existing calculator that this information can be plugged into, and it reports out on the pounds or tons of carbon dioxide, NOx, and SOx avoided. Next, the use of clean diesel fuels and technologies. For this, you need a lot more data. This one's a little more complicated. The EPA's diesel emissions quantifier can be used to measure the results, and as I mentioned earlier, our mobile source team has been very helpful in helping us run the calculator. Third is recovery of methane from landfills. This one is actually quite simple. The metric tons of methane avoided through either reuse or flared times 21 is equal to the metric tons of carbon dioxide avoided. And there's a calculator for that as well. And then finally, for the materials reduced, reused, or recycled, we're tracking the tons and type of material. And there are two existing EPA calculators that we are using to quantify the results, the RECON tool and the waste reduction model, or WARM. So, as I said, we're using existing EPA calculators to measure results. We, you know, all throughout this, we're trying to minimize the amount of effort that we in the region need to take and to maximize our results. The next thing we are working on is really important. We've received some funding from headquarters to develop a database to track our metrics. One of the problems we're having is we now know what data we want to track, but we didn't have a means of collecting it. So we are developing a database, which is actually nearly finished, into which project managers can enter their data. It's very user-friendly. It will then, the database will call out to the calculators. The project managers don't need to do the calculations. They just need to enter their data. And, you know, the formulas are in there, and the environmental benefits will be calculated. That said, so once that database is up and running, we should have a very good means and develop a really good idea of how much environmental benefit we've already achieved through the implementation of our policy. That said, we do have some limited results so far. There are 21 sites in the region that are currently managed by the Army Corps of Engineers. And as I mentioned, they are required under their contract to track green remediation, to implement the policy, sorry. So they have been giving us numbers on a generally quarterly basis that we have been tracking. So we do have some results. In terms of going on to slide 52, in terms of purchase of renewable energy, as of June 2010, all Superfund sites that are managed by the Corps are purchasing renewable energy credits for use on their sites. The average annual cost per site for purchasing these offsets is $6,000. And actually, if you remove a couple of the larger sites, that cost goes down to about $3,500 per site. And again, that's on an annual basis. So if you compare that to the average cost of a cleanup of a Superfund site, it's an impact of less than 1%, much less than 1% of the total remedial cost. By purchasing those renewable energy credits on this select number of sites, so again, we're doing more than this, but for the data that we've already crunched, we can verify offsets of 1,166 metric tons of carbon dioxide, which is equivalent to taking 223 cars off the road annually. So for these 21 sites at a cost of about $120,000, we've taken 223 cars, the equivalent of 223 cars off the road. From the materials management, similarly, we verified results, offsets of at least 914 metric tons of carbon dioxide, which is the equivalent to taking 175 cars off the road. I list here some of the things that sites are reporting on, including tons of paper, cardboard, recycled, treated soil recycled or reused on site, granular activated carbon recycled. And that one, again, I think we're greatly underreporting. Finally, clean diesel. We already have measurable results. Time's running out, so I won't, you can read through this slide at your leisure. And we don't have any results so far yet for methane capture at landfills. But if you go to slide 55, we've already verified offsets of 2,080 metric tons of carbon dioxide, which is equivalent to taking 398 cars off the road annually. The carbon dioxide emissions from the electricity use of 252 homes for 1 year, or the carbon sequestered annually by 443 acres of pine forest. So it's pretty significant what we've already done with very, really limited effort. So moving forward, as I said, this is a living policy. We're actively evaluating new potential touchstone practices. We have work groups looking into Energy Star products and energy efficiency, environmentally preferable purchasing, use of the generation of renewable energy on site, you know, which of course we want to do, but we want to give project managers within the region specific guidance on how they can do that, and we're also looking at sustainable site design. We need to finalize and deploy the database, which we hope will happen within the next 1 to 2 months. I've already seen a near final version, and it's close. It looks great. And finally, we want to acknowledge leaders, particularly among PRPs. You know, they're people who are really going above and beyond what the policy requires, and we want to make sure that they are recognized. And that's it. Slide 57 is a link to where you can find the policy. And my name, as well as Kristen Jacqueline's name, she's also heavily involved with this in the region. So any questions, you can contact either of us. Thank you. Clint?
Wow, Stephanie, some great results for Region 2. And I thought Region 9 was ahead of the curve. You guys are doing a fantastic job. Well, it's finally time to answer some of your questions. We'll start on the phone, and then we'll alternate back and forth between questions on the phone and online. So with that said, are there any questions on the phone lines? If no one speaks up fairly quickly, we are a little bit crunched for time. There is a question online, and I believe the first one, I believe it's for Hillary. Question is, I like the idea of switching to a less energy-intensive remedy after a certain period, but what about documentation? Would EPA have to revise the ROD? What would that ROD amendment or an would that be a ROD amendment or an ESD? And alternately, how has this idea been incorporated into the ROD process at the start? Can you provide any examples?
This is Hillary. If EPA is going to change the remedy, or if PRP or consultant wanted to suggest to EPA that the remedy be changed, there is existing guidance on how that can be done, and whether that's done for a reason that has nothing to do with a greener cleanup, or whether it's done to implement a greener polishing remedy, I think the process would be the same, and so it would depend on the exact site specifics, whether it would be an ESD or a ROD amendment, an ESD being an explanation of significant differences or a moderate degree of change to the remedy. I think in many cases it could be done as an ESD. And I think there was also a part of the question about whether that can be done at the remedy selection stage and sort of incorporate a greener second stage remedy or polishing step into the remedy at the time it's selected, and that could be done. There's nothing to stop EPA from selecting a remedy that has a greener cleanup polishing stage. There are many remedies selected now, many of them selected long before the words green remediation first passed Carlos Pachón's lips or anyone else's, that included a phased remedial approach. So, as is the case with many of these greener cleanup approaches, they're not all new. So we can do that. We've selected remedies with phased approaches in the past, and we can continue to do that going forward. The idea is to do it with a conscious eye towards sustainability, greener cleanups, and doing it with environmental benefit while reducing environmental impact, carbon footprint at the same time. Hope that answers the question.
It seems to be. I think you hit all the points at least. Are there any other questions on the phone line again?
This is Tim Rader in Region A with a question for Stephanie Vaughn. I'm wondering if the Region 2 states are cost-sharing on the fund, or at least for the fund lead sites where RECs are purchased to cover 100% of the energy use on those sites?
Yeah, that's a good question. The states are aware of our policy, and as far as I know, I mean, they will be giving their 10% cost share. So I don't believe that's been a problem as of yet. The cost is relatively small so far.
Okay, question number two online, and I think this is an open-ended question, and I'm not for sure the answer to this, but are the draft BMPs for underground storage tank cleanups on the CLUIN website? I would say if anybody has that answer, knows that answer, if they...
The underground storage tanks... BMP fact sheet is still in development and will be posted, I would imagine, within the next couple of months, according to the current development schedule. Was there a second one that was asked about?
No, that was the only one.
Okay.
About BMPs for USTs.
BMPs for USTs. It's in draft. I would anticipate it will be out within 1 to 2 months on that CLUIN/ Green Remediation website.
Okay. Is there any other questions on the phone? Hearing none, for the sake of time, we'll go back to the online. I think this is for Beth. What were the specific tools used to develop footprints for Well 12A Superfund site? Beth, are you online?
She's involved with an Alaska oil response, and I think she had to go after her presentation, Clint.
What we'll do, actually, the next two are for Beth. As with all these questions, if we don't get to your question, they will be followed up online, and I believe an email will be sent to you to answer the questions. The other one was for Beth. This is the last... One second. Can the greener remediation idea checklist be provided?
Yeah, those checklists are available online. They're definitely on the EPA intranet. But if you can't find it on the EPA intranet, feel free to send me an email and I can forward them on to you.
Okay.
This is Stephanie Vaughn, sorry.
The next question, are the IDEA checklists, okay, which I think you just, are they on the EPA Region 2 website? This was the second question, Stephanie.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they are publicly available, but if you can't access them, then just let me know and we can send them.
Okay. What are the impacts, if any, to site investigations and remedies implemented before GR policies are signed?
Is that one for me, do you think?
I think that's for you.
Okay. Well, the impact to sites that are already underway before the policy was signed can vary. The sites that already have work underway do not need to follow the policy. We can't require that they follow the policy, at least the PRP lead sites, but we can request that they try to follow the policy moving forward. As I said, we're really focusing at this point on ways to green the implementation of a remedy or a site investigation, not ways to change the remedy. So if, let's say, you have a pump and treat system that's been operating for 10 years and it's going to operate for another 10 or 20 years, there are things you can do like doing an audit of the site and improving the efficiency of your system that are green. And you know, if you do that, you should get some credit for the fact that you're doing something green. That's just one example that pops into my mind. So I think the policy can have impacts on sites that are already underway, but we can't require it.
Yeah, and this is Rusty in Region 9. We, don't make a distinction between what happened before the policy was signed and after. So the activities that we've had at our site are both, are mainly from sites that had a rod before our policy was in place. So I don't think there's anything to prevent a project manager who wants to green up their already written rod through implementation by that. At any point, 5-year reviews are a great time to do a wholesale evaluation of your energy usage and processes, but you can also do that during the implementation, or RA activities. You can use cleaner technologies while you're doing the construction.
Okay. We only have time probably for one or two more. Other than Region 2, what other EPA regions are requiring GSR language for CERCLA orders? And a follow-on question is, RCRA also considering GSR language in orders? And I think this is open for any of the other regions.
In Region 9, we have put it into a consent decree. So we'll see how that, it's not signed yet, but we'll see how it goes. We're using language very similar to Region 2's, which says, implement our greener cleanups policy. So I think that it's broad enough to pass scrutiny, and then I think it's when we get down to the, nuts and bolts of it is where we may run into problems.
And for Region 7, at this point in time, we haven't required any in our CERCLA orders. We are contemplating it. We're working towards it. I'm not sure about for RCRA, but at least for CERCLA, we're working towards doing that. But we haven't at this point in time.
I think that's the same in Region 3 as well. This is Hillary Thornton speaking. I believe that's the case here, same as what Clint just described. Working toward it, but not there yet.
And that's the same case for Region 4 as well. This is Julie Santiago, Region 4.
Okay. This will probably be the last question we'll have time for, and the other questions we'll try to get to them at the end of the session. Because not all regions presented, does that mean there are not policies in those regions? There are policies in, I believe, all 10 regions, and I believe They've all been posted on the Kluwen website.
Yes, they have.
Hillary, you might need to confirm that.
Yes, all 10 are up there on the Kluwen. And because we're limited by time, we picked two different regions for each of the three portions of this webinar, or three webinars in this series, I should say. So if you attend all three, or if you listen to the archive versions of all three of these webinars, you'll have heard from 6 of the 10 regions in all. But all 10 have policies.
Sounds great. Okay, we're going to go ahead and start the second half of this. Again, I ask any of you that may have taken your phone off mute for the question and answer session, please put it back on mute by pressing *6 now. Our next speaker is Brad Bradley. Brad is an RPM in EPA Region 5 office. He will present a case study on the Fisher Callow site. Welcome, Bradley.
Hi. My presentation starts on slide 58, and although I was an RPM for 22 years, I've been in the brownfields program now for the last 3. So I've kind of got both perspectives now, and I am the Region 5 Superfund Greener Cleanup Coordinator. Go ahead and go to slide 59. What I'm going to talk about is a pilot study to green and optimize a 10-year operating pump and treat system for the Fisher Callow site. That site's located in Kingsbury, Indiana. It's close to La Porte. It's a former solvent recycling facility. There were a lot of buried drums, quite a few removal actions back in the 90s to get rid of thousands, literally, of buried drums with a lot of solvents in them, including chlorinated. And, of course, along with that came extensive groundwater contamination. And actually, I'm glad to do this for the second time, about 7 months after the first time, because we've learned quite a bit in those 7 months. The system's now been running almost 11 years, so can update that a little bit. The next slide, number 60, is just sort of a larger view of the 4 contaminant plumes, and just note that there is one plume that's up in the upper right-hand corner that's quite a bit farther away from the rest. There's a small shaded square between the two plumes that are down more toward the lower right-hand corner. That's where the treatment building is located. And so one of the things we're looking at is, since that's really more than a mile travel between that plume and the pump and treat system to get it over to the treatment building, we're looking at some options. That's one of the things that just kind of stuck out right away, is why are we pumping that over a mile? Especially since now the groundwater contamination levels in that particular plume that's farther away are quite low. They're still over the drinking water standards, but just marginally. Slide 61. The pilot study was funded by OSWR in 2009. They gave money for greener cleanup pilot studies to several regions, and we did get the one for Fisher Callow. We are, again, in sort of an update to this slide, we're evaluating not using modified LCA, because I think that's a misnomer. We're actually using a footprinting analysis, which is a much better way to do it, the feasibility of optimizing and applying green cleanup measures at that site. Then the second step is we propose suggested modifications based on the footprinting analysis and optimization calculations to the PRP steering committee. There's a very active group at this site. They're amenable to this, but that does add another step in where we don't have total control over it. And then, because, first of all, we got $50,000, and secondly, it was clear that we weren't supposed to construct anything with that money, we would then rely on the PRPs to actually construct and modify the system based on the suggestions. I'm sure they're going to make some modifications. They've already suggested a few things to us that sound pretty reasonable, but we're not going to build anything with that money. Then we're going to do an upfront footprinting analysis, which basically will say, here's the situation today. Here's some options we can use to green and or optimize it. And what does that do in terms of changing the energy consumption, greenhouse gas emissions, water conservation, and basically the other parameters that Region 9 has used in their footprinting analyses for three sites. We're tapped into them pretty heavily because they kind of jumped out in front on this one. And then also, we had the benefit of the responsible parties. They kept comprehensive energy usage data for all of the years of operation. So we have that sort of upfront data that's really good to compare with. Slide 63 is a picture of the inside of the treatment building. It's, you know, with four plumes, you know, there is quite a bit of water being pumped in there and treated. So I just wanted to kind of give you a visual on that. The slide 64 is a picture of something that before we really walked out there and looked at this, we really didn't think about this, but that is the discharge, the clean water discharge from the air strippers going into something called Travis Ditch. And believe me, that water's a lot cleaner than Travis Ditch because that receives a sewage treatment plant outfall. But the point of the slide is that there are other industrial users in this area. It's an old Army munitions facility that has been converted to a lot of industrial usage. And so there are other companies pumping water, and yet here we have this, you know, stream of clean water coming out of our treatment building system. And, you know, maybe we could connect the two dots. So that's, I think a lot of people think of greener cleanups as windmills and solar panels, but it's really a whole lot more than that. It's really sort of innovative thinking and using everything at your disposal to try to make the cleanup greener. And then the next slide, the current status, we have all the initial data. We had to get a lot of treatment system specifics and you know, groundwater contaminant analysis data for the last 10 or 11 years. As I mentioned before, we coordinated with Region 9, not only the Romick site in Palo Alto, but also the BP Wood River site in Illinois and Travis Air Force Base in California as well. What's happened is as those three sites have gone through the footprinting analyses, adjustments have been made and things have been improved. So we're kind of beneficiaries of some of the startup conditions and also some of the improvements that came in the process. And we're hoping that at the end of this that our data will be comparable so that, you know, we'll be talking apples and apples with respect to the three Region 9 pilots. And then lastly, the analysis of various green measures and system optimizations underway. At the end of this presentation, I'll tell you a few problems we ran into, some of which I certainly did not anticipate. And then, obviously, next steps, which is the following slide. Finish the analysis. We got to present the recommendations to PRPs. If it saves money, I think it's an easy answer. But there may be some things which have a payback period of, you know, 5 years or more, and it's going to be a judgment call on their part as to whether they want to do some of those. And the possible glitch is that because we are relying on the PRPs to modify the system or build something if needed, that, you know, if they say no, we won't be able to do the next step as well as we'd like, which is the post-modification footprinting analysis. And then you can just forget that last one because we're not doing modified LCA. Again, this is a footprinting analysis, and that's the right way to go, at least at this time. And then what I wanted to mention, the following slide is just my contact information. I wanted to mention some things that happened. First of all, when we got the money, I put it into our START contract, which is sort of the, you know, kitchen sink contract we have in Region 5. I think that there's a caution there because although I wouldn't have said this prior to 2010, the START contract is subject to if a disaster happens in your region, they will get pulled off, and they will respond to that. And we had four fairly significant oil spills, including a 1 million gallon oil spill near Kalamazoo, Michigan, that really just completely nuked the summer and a good bit of the fall as far as getting my particular project going. So just keep that in mind. I wouldn't have said that before 2010, but we did have a lot of problems this year in Region 5 with oil.
So the START people were pulled off, and we lost a lot of time. Also, $50,000 doesn't go really far, especially since one of the things we're looking at is an innovative technology as far as possibly greening this system. And so, you know, if you don't have nice off-the-shelf numbers, you know, you got to kind of generate that yourself. You might even have to do a pilot, which may be the case here. And so that's something where that starts to run your cost up a bit. It's sort of like the first people that buy something or do something pay a lot of money as soon as they mass produce it. Not the case anymore. But we're glad to be one of the first ones through the door. Unfortunately, though, that does strain the budget. Our new timeline is basically we now have the work plan all done. You know, we've outlined the footprint analyses we're going to do. The responsible parties are getting us comments basically next Tuesday. And then we will begin those analyses. We also have looked for some help from headquarters with respect to the optimization piece, so that'll help us stretch that $50,000 a little more. And then probably my last statement is, after I got involved with looking at the Region 9 footprinting analyses and talking to Carlos Pachon quite a bit for many different reasons over the past 6 months or so, I really think that the footprinting analysis is a good way to go. There's a lot of efforts underway in other groups. There's an ASTM green cleanup standard being developed. There's a sustainable remediation forum, ITRC, et cetera. And we're all sort of grappling with how do we measure this, compare it. And I think that that the footprinting analysis, at least for our purposes on this site, really seems to be a good fit. And that's the end of my presentation, and I can take questions later when this session is done if anyone has any. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad. You're exactly right. I think footprint analysis is a great way to go. I'm looking at it one of my sites. So anyway, some good points. Once again, those of you on the phone and online, make sure if you have any questions, we're only going to have one more speaker, so go ahead and type in your questions at this time. Our final speaker for this webinar is Martin Zalesnik. Martin works in EPA Region 4's office, and he will be presenting some results from a pilot study which looked at GR tools during the feasibility stage. Welcome, Martin.
One correction there. I work in Region 9, so I'm out here with Rusty and Mike Kell here, so just a point of clarification on that. Yes, next slide goes to be slide 69. I'm going to basically say that the timing here was really good. I have a fund lead site, and for those who are not familiar with EPA language, when we say fund lead, this means that EPA, there are no PRPs, and EPA has the lead in doing a cleanup. So I was looking at doing a simple feasibility study, and they were looking for a pilot study to use this footprint analysis tool, and I said, you know, timing's right. I really wanted to, my goal here was to learn about the tool and how it could be used and when and where it could be used. So the feasibility study was pretty straightforward. It was a pump and treat and an in-situ chemical oxidation comparison. And the tool was being developed as we were working on it, so things were going on together at the same time. Next slide. Tucson. Well, Tucson's been in the news quite a bit recently. I would be remiss not speaking something about it. I worked with the community there. They're a very engaged community on all issues and stuff. There's real tragedy there, but I have a community meeting next week, and I really enjoy working with them. They're all very involved and engaged, and it's just sad that something like that could happen. All right, next slide. Okay, this is the actual Superfund, the plume, the groundwater plume, and it extends about 3 miles long. It's the Superfund site where the contamination actually reached the public water supply, and it was served to the public for more than a few years, and that's one of the early ones on the NPL. Now, if you look at this map, you'll see the big long plume. Then you look to the west, you'll see kind of a smaller plume, and that's what we call Area B, and that's what we're going to be focusing our talk on here. Next slide. So, okay, when you're looking at this map, it's not coming across real clearly, but if you look at the bottom of the slide in the center, there's like the plume, and there's two operable units down there. One is what we call WestCap, and that's the EPA one, and there's another one with the Texas Instruments, and it's just a little dot right above the big plume, and you can barely see it on this map. I'm sorry about that. But the importance of this is understanding was that the Texas Instruments was found first, and that plays into the sequence of events. Next slide. So this is a fun lead site, and Texas Instruments was using the treated water for the industrial process. And EPA said, well, you know, we could put a treatment plant in so close and figure out a way to discharge the water. Well, we decided to work in the same treatment plant, and that was we negotiated the cost of treatment. This is a win-win situation for everybody. Texas Instruments was getting free water. They didn't need to use municipal water to treat. And we were getting treatment, and it was all working out. But in the private sector, when you have those things, they're not always around. In 2007, they decided they're going to cut down the manufacturing process, and we were saying, oops, we need to do something here. But at the same time, we were lucky enough because, we were thinking about joining the Citrus Chemical Oxidation. We were considering it anyway. So this is a case where you take what looks like to be a problem, and we managed to make it an advantage. So next slide. This is an old rod for Texas Instruments. Basically, what I'm going to show you is that it was just pump and treat. They really weren't addressing the source area at all. So since 1992, when they turned off the well, they still had contamination really high. They weren't getting to the source area. So we really did need a change. And so this treatment plant being shut down, like I said, it was a good time for us to look at this. Next slide. So you might want to know why we jumped to potassium permanganate for the actual in situ chemical oxidation process. There were other OUs in the area that at the site that were using it. The community was more familiar with it. And, in fact, the local high school students came in, did lab experiments, and it worked very well because you could see the community became very comfortable with this idea of using it in situ chemical oxidation. Next slide. All right, so now we're going to get basically into the footprint study. As Brad mentioned earlier, this footprint tool was developed for Aramic, which was a RCRA site. I was fortunate enough to have Karen Schumann. She works in this region, so when I had questions, she was able to talk me through them. So, in essence, these are spreadsheet tools, we were, taking the data, and they would quantify the different elements. I wanted to try to use this up front as a comparative tool between the two remedies, but I'm not saying this was part of the selection criteria. This is just a supportive tool. So, next slide. So the data needs. I want to say here as a project manager that the data needs that they needed to do the footprint analysis, I thought was pretty straightforward. It wasn't that onerous for the me and our contractor to go ahead and develop the data that needed to be plugged in for the footprint analysis. It was pretty straightforward. We were able to get it to them in a day and a half. But that was really something that I wanted to know about if the tool was how much work would be on us. And from a project manager perspective, I didn't think it was that hard. Next slide. So as with the footprint analysis, you have the five core elements, energy, atmosphere, water, material use, and land and ecosystem. So we were going to, the footprint analysis would go through each one of these individually. Next slide. So, we weren't going to be surprised here. Obviously, pump and treat is going to use a lot of energy, and the in-situ chemical oxidation is going to be pretty small. But it quantifies it, and that's something that's nice to have. It's a quantification of what you saved or what is not being, what has been saved from the comparison. Next slide. Same thing here, quantifying the CO2 emissions. So, again, very useful to have that. You can always say you think you know it, but it's nice to quantify it. Next slide. I found this kind of interesting, just looking at the contributors to the in-situ chemical oxidation footprint. If you look to the far right, there's that blow it up. Actually, you can't read it on the slide very well, but what that is the contribution from the lab analysis. That's something I never really thought about before, is that we are going to have a footprint that's result from any lab analysis that's being done at a Superfund remedy, and comparatively, that lab analysis is kind of high. compared to everything else. And that was one of the discussions at NARPM I thought was kind of interesting, was that we led into a discussion about maybe, you know, we're starting to look at our labs and figuring out how labs can be greener, because the labs do play into our cleanup process. Next slide. So, and then the footprint analysis itself, again, you can't read it. It's mainly electricity production. That's obviously the big driver there. Again, I apologize. I didn't know these slides wouldn't be reading so well. Next one. So, and at the same time, when you're doing the footprint analysis and we had an existing remedy, we were actually being able to sit down and look at the pump and treat system and consider changes and make the pump and treat system as optimized as we can, and we could see what the footprints would do. So even though the original pump and treat, we can cut it in half, it doesn't come close to what the in situ chemical oxidation footprint is. Next slide. So doing the five parameters, the water footprint between these two remedies, is we would be re-injecting it, so there wouldn't be much of a water footprint here. And the waste generation is pretty small. And the ecosystem one, to be honest, this is right next to the runway at the airport. I mean, there's not much of an ecosystem near the airport that we would be looking at. Next slide. So I wanted to kind of jump to some of the conclusions, and I learned more after NARPM, and I'm going to share them here, is that there is value in quantifying the, so I would recommend people to consider using the footprint analysis tool. But I will say this, is that do not jump and do the footprint analysis early. It probably should wait till you're very late into the FS stage, because when you're doing this FS, the alternatives switch around, and then all of a sudden that just requires more number crunching in the footprint analysis. And you want to have your feasibility study pretty solid before you want to go back in and do the footprint analysis. We found that, you know, when you have differences in the actual footprint, that it doesn't really matter when you do these tweaking, so you're better off just waiting till it's toward the end. In this particular case, we're, you know, taking the footprint analysis report. We're going to be using an attachment in the FS, which is still in the draft stage, but close to being done. And I also thought that in this particular case, the footprint analysis was reasonably priced. It was it's not that much when you add it compared to the actual FS. It's really kind of small. So my goal here was really to introduce the tool and see what pluses and minuses were working with it, and I really wasn't hoping to get into discussion on the actual feasibility study. I do know, I want to let you know that the more people that use this tool, it's going to be cheaper and better to use, and I'm hoping that as a project manager, we'll be using it in the future. All right, that's it. I think we are way ahead of schedule. Questions? I guess we turn it over to Clint.
That's right. Thank you very much, Martin. Sorry about the earlier. I messed up on the Region 4 stuff, but anyway. That was our last presentation, so the remainder of the time of the webinar can be devoted to question and answers. You may ask questions about any of the presentations, but particularly interested in hearing questions having to do with the last two presentations. We'll also go back and catch up from the two questions that we didn't do the first half. As before, I'll start with the phone and then alternate between the questions from the phone and online as needed. Is there anyone on the line that has a question? Okay. First online question. This is open to all. Are federal facility sites implementing the green remediation policy in their cleanups? I would have to say all of the DOD agencies are the DOD, like Army, Navy, and Air Force. They have their own policy in each one of them. I'm not sure about some of the other agencies, you know, like GSA, DOL, DOI. Does anybody else know? Does everybody hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Don't forget to take your line off mute if you need to talk. Okay. All right. So at this point in time, I don't know if any other agency other than DOD and EPA have has a green remediation policy in their cleanups. Second question, are there any regulatory incentives for voluntary implementing GR practices like purchasing renewable credits? I don't know of any regulatory incentives that are out there for doing something like that. Does anybody else have any ideas on that? Hillary or Mike or somebody? Stephanie?
This is Rusty. I know that in California when Aerojet built their solar farm as part of their remedy, this was done. They got a lot of tax credits for it and, you know, the renewable energy credits through the state and through the federal government made it really cost-effective for them to do their renewable energy farm. So they did the installation, and the way it's set up, the benefits were spread through the utility and the developer as well as the PRP. So I think that there's some of those benefits. I don't know if any – I haven't heard of any regulatory benefits like, you know, that you would get from a cleanup.
This is Mike Gill in Region 9. I would also add that there's a resource out there. It covers mostly western states. It's called the Smart Energy Resources Guide, and it has some information resources for what states might offer. So it's the SERGE, the Smart Energy Resources Guide. You can find it online if you just, I think if you Google EPA and SERG.
This is Hillary Thornton in Region 3. We are working on...
Hillary, you might have to speak up. We can't hear you very well.
This is Hillary Thornton in Region 3, and we are working on steps to acknowledge companies or others who are taking steps. And I noticed on Stephanie's slide 56, she has acknowledged leaders as one of the bullets on her next step. So I think Region 2 is also working on acknowledging those who are leading in these efforts. So that's not a direct regulatory incentive, but it is an incentive of the public relations sort, you know, getting recognition for what they're doing. And I think a lot of companies out there do want to be seen as being green. You know, green is the new black, green is cool, green is in, they want to be green. And one thing that we have that we can offer them is recognition for doing the right thing, doing the green thing.
Thank you, everyone. Is there any questions over the phone lines? I think everybody's afraid to ask a question on the line, on phone line. Okay. Is there a glossary of all these acronyms? I am sure there is. I don't know the exact website. Would somebody know, is it on CLUIN or is it just on the EPA, main EPA website?
Usually there's a list of acronyms at the beginning of each EPA document, but that's not addressing every acronym that might be covered here. So, you know, if you have a guidance document that you can focus on, then usually the first few pages near the table of contents does have that list of acronyms.
Mike, the Green Remediation Primer that folks may be familiar with, one of the documents that is linked to on the CLUIN/Green Remediation page, does have an acronyms and abbreviations section near the front of it.
Yeah, you could also look at the Superfund Green Remediation Strategy that was released in like end of September of 2010.
Great, thanks. This is a question for Brad Bradley. Is Region 5 working towards incorporating GSR language in RCRA and CERCLA orders, utility permits, et cetera, similar to Region 2's effort?
Okay. I can't really speak for RCRA, although I do work fairly closely with Gary Victorine, who's sort of my counterpart for land and chemicals. I don't think they're really doing it, but without him on the phone, I don't really want to go too far with that. As far as Superfund, we don't have anything yet. It's sort of the same answer that I think you got from Hillary and Julie that we're working on it, but no, it's not done yet.
Okay. I think this is open to all. When will the ASTM GSR standard be complete and available for the public? And I know Patricia Overmeyer, she is not, I don't believe she is on.
Well, I work on that too. This is Brad. They're having a meeting today and tomorrow to sort of hammer out the best management practices. I can't give you a date because the ASTM process is a consensus process. There will be at least one more vote on the document, but I think, you know, we've come a long way, let's put it that way, and it's really hard to throw a date out, but it's not going to happen, you know, by the midpoint of the year, I would say, because I think we have a meeting in April to vote again, and unless everybody's completely happy with it, which is very unlikely, it won't happen at that point. It's really hard to predict things with the ASTM process because it's a consensus process. And there's a lot of different disciplines involved. That's a good thing, but obviously then you have some, you know, movement back and forth on some issues.
And if I recall right, I think ASTM's been working on this for a little over 2 years. Is that correct, Brad?
Yeah, it really started cranking up though. I think about a year and a quarter ago. That's when it, you know, they started throwing drafts around and got things moving.
Right. Okay, I'll get, there's several more online. Says, Region 2 mentioned that they have created a site assessment, RIFS, RDRA, GRIDEA checklist. I cannot find them on their website, and they wanted to know if there was a link, if we could send them a link. Stephanie, are you on? What we can do is follow up on that. I'll leave that on, and we'll see if Stephanie can send a link to answer your question. Next question, are spreadsheets for footprint available online?
I don't think so. You would probably need to go through Carla's Bashan on that. Karen, can you speak to that?
Yeah, this is Karen Sherman, and I've been working on some analyses just like you heard of today with Tucson Resorts. And we have some spreadsheets up on Cluin. One of them is for ROMIC, East Palo Alto, and the other one is for BP Wood River. And did you give a link to anything on your, not to Cluin or anything?
No.
So if the listeners have a link to Cluin from another source and get on Cluin, they can find a link on that website. You can see a link to footprint analyses, and then you can get the spreadsheets off of that. And these are spreadsheets for two other analyses similar to the ones that you heard of from Martin today on Tucson, the Tucson Airport WestCap site. And the spreadsheets are in PDF format, but they show how that kind of analysis has been done for other sites as well.
Okay, this next question, I don't know who it's addressed to. Possibly it's addressed to either, might be addressed to Martin, came about the same time. It says, can you tell us the name of the GR tool used?
Yeah, again, the name of the tool is funny because we really haven't come up with the name of the tool, and I keep on pressing Carlos on that too. We got to get this thing named. But right now we just call it the footprint analysis tool.
Okay. The last
maybe he doesn't
online,
like the acronym, huh?
Say that again?
I said maybe he doesn't like the acronym of footprint analysis tool.
Yeah.
Maybe not. Okay, this is the last question we have online. Is the footprint tool that was used for the Tucson analysis available for use on other sites? If so, how can one get a copy of the footprint tool? That's there's a two-part question. That's the first question. Go ahead.
Just answer.
Again, this is Karen Sherman, and that set of spreadsheets, I kind of hesitate to call it a tool. It's a set of spreadsheets specific for the site, whatever site it's been, the spreadsheets have been applied to. So far, out of Region 9, we've applied the set of spreadsheets to three sites and are working on a fourth. And, again, the spreadsheets can be found on CLUIN. And I'm sorry that we don't have the link up there, but hopefully anybody interested can get on CLUIN and find the link to the tool, to the spreadsheets that way.
Okay, the second part of the question is, do you have any observations about how the footprint tool differs from other GR calculators and tools?
Yes, this is Karen Sherman again. And I think that one of the main differences is it's a very detailed set of analyses, whereas the SRT that the Air Force has done is a little bit more, well, it's certainly more streamlined and likely to be more, the user is probably able to complete an analysis more quickly than using the set of spreadsheets that we've developed. So the SRT is going to be quicker and probably easier to use for the user. It's likely to give a more general results. In other words, it'll use some generalized assumptions that may not be appropriate for the site that you have, but that will at least give you a good overview and a general idea of the footprint. Now, if you wanted a much more specific sort of a set of results, then I think SiteWise is likely to give you a more specific set of results. Again, that will take more effort to get that and more specific information from your site to enter into the SiteWise tool. And then finally, the spreadsheets that we use, I think, are likely to be even more specific than SiteWise. And kind of more hands-on. You definitely have to know Excel, how to use Excel, and you really have to understand all of the assumptions being made in the spreadsheets and understand whether they're appropriate for your site. So I think it just gets to the level of specificity that you're interested in and also the amount of time that you're able to spend.
There's one more thing, too. I know that the SRT, they use worker safety as one of the factors, too, and I don't think that's something that we count twice on what we're doing at EPA.
Sounds great. Are there any other questions on the phone lines? Okay, hearing none. Again, on the last slide, it talks about if you would like to see additional resources, you can click on that link. And if you wouldn't mind, we'd love to hear back from you to see how we can improve things or any ways we might be able to help you. That would be really great. Again, thanks to all who participated, and especially to today's presenters. Again, we have one more webinar in the series, which is scheduled for February the 10th. At 1:00 Eastern Time. Again, it's going to be a two-hour webinar. And with that said, I hope everyone has a great day, and hope to talk to you guys next month. Thanks.